There have been recent developments regarding Operation Kino.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Operation Kino, the newly named podcast, which is the same podcast you've been listening to with me and my three co-hosts. But now we have a name, which is very exciting for us. I guess to kick off our first named podcast, everybody introduce yourselves, starting with David.
I am David Ehrlich, formerly of Cinematical.com. May she rest in peace.
And R.I.P.
Now of the unknown future.
Matt Patches.
I am Matt Patches. I write for various websites, slutting it up across the internet. And I'm I'm now working for more places than David Ehrlich.
Wow.
Oh, sad.
Dave?
My name's Dave. I spell it with a 7, and Eric Davis told me he didn't need any more writers when I asked if I could work for Cinematical two years ago. So rest in peace, but I'm at Latino Review now. And here, doing Operation Kino. It's a thing. I have to start telling people. It's a thing.
Yeah, this is my only outlet.
That's true. This is what we're going to tell publicists when we try to go to screen, when we all try to go see Arthur.
What are you talking? I have told publicists.
I know. I'm speaking truths.
You mean when we all try to go see Arthur again tomorrow?
We'll get to that. Since we've already mentioned Cinematical like 3 or 4 times over the course of this, we should talk about the elephant in the room, which today when we're recording this, today and yesterday were kind of the big days for the death of Cinematical to take over our minds. But it's a sad week. It's the death of Cinematical. And David, as a person who wrote for them, yesterday, when was the last
it was sort of silly as a freelancer to send in, I don't know, my wording was very juvenile and choice, but I wrote something about tendering my resignation, but I was like,
you may want to give context to the situation very briefly, since we're hoping that people beyond our friends are listening.
But the major idea of it is that Cinematical was a wonderful website that relied on a core group of editors and then freelancers like myself scattered throughout the country who were wrote about what they loved and were allowed to do so by a wonderful and caring team of editors who really catered to people's specific and individual interests and tried to get the best out of the writers in a way that benefited everybody involved. And Cinematical was part of Movie Phone, which is owned by AOL, and there have been a lot of things happening with the Huffington Post and AOL recently.
Mainly that AOL bought the Huffington Post.
Mainly that. And it was really sort of AOL seemed very uncertain. I mean, I really don't feel comfortable talking about what happened or making – it would all be speculation and conjecture for me because I'm not involved at that level.
Okay.
All I can say is that Cinematical has – Eric Davis, who was the editor-in-chief, departed, and and then they sent that email out that everybody's read by now that pretty much said, and there's a lot of controversy around this, it was written by Patricia Chui, who was the editor-in-chief of Movie Phone. Who I've never met in person, but I've spoken to and it was always very kind to me, and I think I share I'll express the sentiment of everybody involved. From the Cinematical side, that says that she was doing a lovely job and is taking the fall, undeservedly so, from the Huffington side. But she sent out that email that said that, freelancers are they're going to be moving away from the freelancer model, but of course you're still invited to – we value your work, so you're still invited to work for us for free, which – again, I'm not going to get into, but essentially,
which is something that you can't do, basically. Right. Like if you want to make money in this world,
of course. And if you're writing simply for the exposure for whatnot, I mean, who's — and you're writing for a corporation — who's out there to value what you're writing? Who's out there to notice the work that you're putting in and pay you for it? But I think that I can only speak for myself when I say that I owe whatever marginal success and platform that I have in this world of movie blogging to Eric Davis, who took a chance on me, and his team, who have supported me over the past year. And there was just no – it was not an option for me to continue writing for Cinematical, for Movie Phone, continuing my Criterion Corner column there. without Eric and company being around. I owe my loyalty to him, and you know, it was without a second thought that myself and the rest of the team departed. And Cinematical is on. You know, I still got an email today from Movie Phone that was saying, and I read a story recently that I think was part of that Ann Thompson story that said that AOL and HuffPo hope to continue the Cinematical brand and keep using it, you know, to appeal to the hardcore film geek, while Movie Phone caters to the masses. But with you know, overwhelming majority of the writing staff, I mean, prohibitive majority, having abandoned ship along with our captains, I don't know who they plan on relying on to continue catering to the hardcore.
So it's basically zombie Cinematical.
It's zombie Cinematical. It is undead. And
I think I read that email too, and I think they actually say that Movie Phone will be the ones appealing to, you know, the real film fans.
Which seems insane.
I would say that based on what I've read in the last hour, that is not true. I think that the last thing I read most recently said that they're going to continue the model of Movie Phone catering to the masses and Cinematical appealing to the hardcore geek fan. Until I read otherwise, I that's the latest I know. But
farewell, Cinematical. We'll miss you.
Save us, Cinema Blend.
I know. Cinema Blend is your savior in the ashes. Except, I mean, we're just as tight. Anyway. All right.
Speaking of ashes and phoenixes and Jesus.
We haven't even started talking about God.
It was more of a soliloquy. But in all fairness, that is the work that I've devoted my film writing time to for the past year. And it's been a tumultuous few days just watching, even as someone who's, you know, involved in some small way. But anyway,
RIP.
Moving on. Thank you for the opportunity. I have the least cogent things to say about that, but it's going to be okay.
But yeah, speaking about Rising from the Dead, Dave, as you suggested as a segue.
Happy Easter, everybody, early.
Happy early. Hey, it's not Easter. I gave up candy for Lent, and I'm counting down the days until Easter, so don't tease me.
Okay.
But we're going to be reviewing Arthur tonight, but three of us actually also saw Soul Surfer, which kind of took me by surprise since we, you know, write on the internet and Soul Surfer isn't exactly tearing up the blogosphere. And aside from kind of what we thought of the movie in general, I actually don't really know, David, what you thought of Soul Surfer. Patches and I got in, I wouldn't call it a fight, a heated discussion.
Can we pause a moment and remember that some people are completely ignorant to Soul Surfer opening on Friday and explain what the movie is?
Okay, yes.
Once upon a time, there was a young lady who loved Jesus. And Jesus loved her so much that he sent a CG shark to tear her arm off. And then she became a surfing champion. And because she only had one arm, she was able to embrace the world more than she ever could have.
Yeah, like only Def Leppard drummers before her.
It's a biopic about Bethany Hamilton starring Anna Sophia Robb and Kevin Sorbo, was robbed of top billing.
Also Dennis Quaid. We need to appreciate the fact that Dennis Quaid's in this movie.
It stars the Dennis Quaid face. I don't know if Dennis Quaid's body was actually attracted to it, but there are certainly a lot of close-ups of him making that crooked, endearing Disney dad Dennis Quaid smile.
Patches, why don't you run down the religious themes in this and what got your goat about it?
Okay, so Soul Surfer was a surprising time for me because I actually enjoy this film, and while we're not going to spend time reviewing it, I will say that for a really over-the-top, sappy, inspirational sports movie, I quite enjoyed it, in a way. But I will never like this movie, and I will never, ever recommend it to anybody, ever. I think it is venomous. I think it is a problem that I have with a lot of movies of this type. And unfortunately for me, and I don't want this issue to kind of stand in my way
movies of this type? Is there a whole genre of Jesus worshiping surfer girls that I've been aware of?
Positive, but yeah, my major problem with the film is that it is seeping with God-fearing religious overtones that kind of undermine its entire message. And
which is what is the message?
Well, basically the message that it would like to have is, you know, you get your arm bit off by a shark, but it doesn't matter because you have the power as an individual to overcome these challenges and to rise up and fulfill your goals and become – you are still a person. You still have the ability to do anything that you want to do, even in the face of this disaster. Unfortunately, when Carrie Underwood, the youth group leader, keeps telling you that, you know, God has a plan for you and that God will always be there for you and he's doing this for you and helping you, that really, no matter what you do, it's not your fault. It's because God gave you the power to do it. It's because God is helping you do it. So it actually is not about you rising to the occasion. It's about how God helped you to do so. And I have a problem with all these movies that kind of do this. And I think that we're seeing them more and more because the business to the Christian community is a growing one every day. Obviously, we see that with ever since Passion of the Christ came out and they started playing it in theater or churches and making money that way. You know, the whole Christian video enterprise has been growing and growing and growing. And this film, I didn't realize it beforehand, is another one that's going to cater to that audience and unfortunately going to be seen by a lot of people who might not be in that camp necessarily. But I hate this movie. And this is coming from a personal opinion, obviously. But I don't like this film because it undermines its own inspirational, valuable message.
I couldn't agree more verbatim with what Patches said. I had the exact same feeling while watching it. That being said, if you go to Bethany Hamilton's website, before you're allowed to see a picture of her, you know, access the homepage, you are treated to a quote from Jesus himself. So clearly, I mean, and you know, as they show in the end credits of the film, when she accepts her honorary Teen Spirit Award or whatever it was, she thanks Jesus, who you know, personally orchestrated the amputation of her arm. Obviously, you know, her faith is very important to her. And I'm glad that they didn't, you know, try to sugarcoat that in order to make it more palatable to a less Jesus-oriented Christian. Right, audience. That being said, what Patches is saying, I not agree with.
Yeah, wait. Does it paint a divine force being part of the motivating her, or is it just it chooses to show all of these?
In some of the final shots where she spoiler alert, everybody, she rides this one big wave at the end, and when she succeeds and finally overcomes all this, you know, turmoil she's been under, she points to the sky while she's riding on the surface.
But that's what she does. That's not the movie saying, hey, look at that. God gave her the power. That's her as a character.
Yes, it is.
Well, but see, the thing is, if they don't show any sort of outside nature, or if there's not a character or plot line of somebody who managed to succeed despite the disability without God, then that is what the movie's saying.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what happens is that she... And, you know, this is – it's as far as spoiler territory is concerned, it's really like talking about 127 hours.
Yeah, the only other ending is that she killed the shark. That's the only other ending in the picture.
That's after the credits. She goes back in the water and murders that fucker. Actually, the shark dies.
No, the shark does die. That's
the shark definitely
God
dies.
God kills the shark.
Hey,
the shark is transubstantiated from CG to rubber. In the second act of this movie. It's amazing to watch. But, I mean, the movie really does, as far as I was concerned, in my opinion, dovetails with Patches here, I have to say, Katie, is that it really seems to suggest, particularly with its concluding notes, that and with that whole trip to Indonesia and whatnot, that anything is – I mean, and they start with that, first, you know, church bit with Carrie Underwood where it's about perspective and they show the fly's eye and they say that, you know, it's really a matter of perspective. And it's as if, I mean, the movie is so steering Bethany Hamilton, who's played very winningly by Anna Sophia Robb, who deserves better, as I'm sure Bethany Hamilton does herself. It's so steered her
towards... She deserves better than having her arm bitten off by a shark.
Right. It's so steered her towards his attack that it almost felt like the Truman Show to me. Like, everyone else, the audience included, knew that she was being set up for a fall. Which I guess
it was
to some
God's
extent
plan.
We did.
Didn't you hear that?
But,
it was God's plan for her to get her arm bit off.
And she says, like, Jesus, God is in the waves. But the message really comes across at the end. Like, you know, she has this resiliency and she has this quiet... strength, which is, you know, very impressive and moving, and especially someone so young, but it completely undercuts all of that by saying at the end, she's like, the movie effectively says, I couldn't have done this without Jesus. Yep. He is what what powered me through these dark times, and God forbid, God forsake that the people who go through such trauma and tragedy and don't have faith on their side, because then they have nothing.
Come,
even though the movie repeatedly,
that is not what the movie
repeatedly
says.
Showers love upon her family, her support system, her inner strength. It completely underscores all of that by saying that
hold
they
on,
would
David.
All not had she not had.
I really ruffled Katie's feathers the other day after we got out of the movie, and I want to hear why. Well, Katie, what was I going on about that?
So we're talking about two different things here, and one of them is the way that the movie presents faith and whether or not it presents this as a character who has strong faith in God and personally believes in God, or whether it's a movie that evangelizes and says, if you don't have this faith in God, you will not be able to survive having a shark bite off your arm. And I would argue vehemently that it is not evangelistic, and I've seen evangelistic Christian movies, and I really don't think this is that. But the thing that catches
What's in the movie that makes you think that?
That makes you think it isn't evangelistic?
Like, is your knowledge of the fact that other people have survived shark bites is what is making you think that this one, doesn't have a strong Christian bent? Because if it's not in the movie, then you can't count it as part of its, theme. If the movie is like, I survived this shark bite because of Jesus, is there anything in the movie that isn't touched by God? Is it portrayed as good or evil?
Kevin Sorbo. He's the only thing that it says,
Kevin
if you
Sorbo
have Kevin Sorbo,
is
you
God.
Don't need Jesus.
Kevin Sorbo is touched by God, undeniably. He's Kevin fucking Sorbo.
His abs were touched by God. The man has four lines in the movie, and I was genuinely, even though I wrote it on my notes, Sorbo across the top. I thought that he was very effective and had a large part to do with the fact that the movie is, despite itself, quite moving.
But I mean, is there a counterpoint, is what I'm asking, Katie.
No, I don't think the movie has to have a counterpoint. The movie is presenting a character who has strong faith in God, who is raised in a community that has strong faith in God. It shows her going to church. It shows her going to youth group. Yes, it lingers on faith in a way that it probably wouldn't have if it didn't have to work with a subject who insisted on this. She goes on this mission trip to Indonesia after the tsunami. That doesn't really have anything to do with anything, but it happened and she wanted that to be in there. But I don't think, she's got a voiceover throughout the movie in which she talks about, because this is an awkward movie, and it's got the voiceover because it's based on her memoir. But it doesn't have her saying, I only survived this because of Jesus. I hope you find Jesus so you can survive.
But yes, it does. She explicitly says that God works in mysterious ways. Like, there's that whole bit about God working in mysterious ways and how her faith brought her to this point.
Yeah, but that's not her saying you will be smoked if you don't have faith in God.
I do not think that the film says, you will be smited if you don't believe in God. I do not believe that. But I do think that this film completely tells you that without faith that you can't overcome tragedy in your life, or when you have tragedy in your life, turn to God because he's the one who can help you solve your problems. And I think
it presents a character saying
one character, then it's not that character imposing a view of the character, it's that character imposing the movie's view.
The movie is divided upon itself. I mean, it wants to have it both ways. It wants to be able to say, she was a particularly strong young woman who was able to overcome this, traumatic, dream-crushing obstacle because of her resiliency and because of her support system that she had, in her earthly family. But it also wants to say that for reasons that are never really explained, I mean, it's sort of understood that she has this passion and this faith, this belief in God that it's never really given any sort of background, but that she has that as well, and it never really finds a way for one to complement the other in a way that says, this is a remarkable person who was able to use all of the resources available to her, tangible or otherwise, or metaphysical, or spiritual, to overcome this. It just throws everything at you, and the notes that it strikes at the end does leave a lingering taste, where she almost literally says, to pack up with Patrick, she almost literally says, I could not, thank God I had God. Because
there's a moment in the film when I knew
I could not have done this without him.
There's a moment in the film when I knew it was a brainwashing film.
Oh my God.
I can hear Katie seething. Let me finish this comment. There's one moment in the film when I knew it was a brainwashing film. Right after she gets her arm bit off. You know, we're going into total spoiler, whatever. What? She gets her arm bit off by the shark. She's very upset. She can't cut fruit. That's horrible. I mean, that's obvious. She goes to Carrie Underwood, the youth group leader, and she says to her, you know, why would God do this to me? Like any other, if you were a God-fearing person and a shark bit your arm off, you'd probably wonder the same thing. Why the hell is God, if he's real, having sharks bite my arm off? And all she can tell her is that it's God's plan and that God intended for this to happen to her so that something wonderful could happen. And that is brainwashing.
Oh, okay. I'm going to step in right here. Wait. Dave's talking. Okay. Matt, what you just said is kind of more an assault on the way religious people deal with tragedy and less assault on this movie. Katie, wait. I feel like Matt, David, your guys' point is there. It's like a, you know, guy that knocked on your door and, you know, came in selling Bibles and ended up talking to you for 2 hours and you hated it. Katie, why don't you get the last word on this before we move on?
Oh my God, Rod, we haven't even gotten to the thing that Patches made me so mad about.
Okay, well, yeah, okay, well, go, get to it. I'll cut it up. Okay. Let's do it. Let's go.
All right, I'm not going to argue that the movie has Christian themes. I'm not going to argue that the movie leans heavily on the Christian themes and that because it's an awkwardly made movie, it's not particularly subtle about it. I don't think you can come out of this not knowing that it's trying to, you know, talk about Christian faith. I don't understand why it's offensive to have that in there. Why having a movie about someone who is a remarkable person who did remarkable things and believes that that strength came from God is an offensive thing. And Patches, this is what we got so upset about, is that you saying believing that you're giving strength from God means you're discounting your own strength, which I don't think is true. Yes. Everything that I've learned, being raised in a religious background, I don't believe that's true. I don't think most people who are religious think that's true. And I don't see why it's offensive to see a movie
that
speaks
like
that.
Wait, hey,
I'm not done talking. I'm listening to you
go,
and David.
Lady, go.
No, I don't get how a movie about 127 hours, he gets through this ordeal by being, you know, whatever, like believing in his family and believing in himself.
Believes in the power of his own urine.
He believes in the power of his own urine.
It's important.
And he has these flashes to his family, and that's what gets him through. In Soul Surfer, she's, you know, in the hospital and sees herself going through this tunnel into the light. And gets through because of a faith in God. I don't see how one is more offensive than the other.
Sure.
But that's, well, I think what...
I think I wait, David. So this is what we were talking about after the film. And I think what I told you is that in the context of the film, it doesn't actually seem that unreasonable. And I would probably agree with you. But my problem is that the religion that it's... And this is my own personal opinion now. Obviously, a lot of other people don't agree with this. But the religion that it's promoting has a larger context outside of the film, and that's where I begin to think the film is dangerous. I think films like this are dangerous because it ends up promoting something bigger than it allows you to see in the film and spread something that I don't think is helpful to people. I do think it I disagree with you, Katie, that this film undermine a person.
David, let Patches finish.
I was just going to say that it does indeed undermine the human spirit, which is something that I think religion, especially the Christian point of views that this movie promotes, also does. It undermines the individual. Sure, go.
You rejected Christianity.
Let's not lose focus on the fact that I – you know, to completely go against what Patches said, my problem is explicitly as far as the context of this movie is concerned, because I have, you know, I'm perfectly comfortable in my own. I mean, I understand where Patches is coming from and saying the movie's dangerous, but I think it's dangerous purely in the context of the film, because it's doing is it's setting up this narrative where it's saying that, you know, kids out there, and this is a film that's made, you know, for a particular demographic who's very impressionable. And it's saying, you know, kids, you can overcome certain challenges in your life if you have the resolve and if you have the certain perspective, which is the message that the film starts out on. I mean, it's very, you know, brazen and has no interest in subtlety as far as discussing that message is concerned. However, it then pulls a very quick 180 in saying, fuck that. That shit's not going to work unless you have this very firm and unyielding belief system in our Lord Jesus Christ. And
I would never argue that the film's
– But I don't want to take Patches – I don't want to – I just want to say my problem is explicitly with the context of the film. I don't want to talk about religion in a grander scheme or how it – you know, movies are – sort of divesting it, whatever. I mean, I just think that the movie wants to have it in two very different ways that completely counteract one another rather than complement one another. And it doesn't make it a dangerous film, in my estimation, but it makes it a totally useless one. And Carrie Underwood's character is also a giant cunt because
she sucks.
Her
obviously.
Point is her triumphant moment is saying, if you don't fucking come to Indonesia, you are always going to be remembered as the girl who didn't go to Indonesia. and it is just this rude and completely ingracious moment that it really casts this like negative taste for me, who doesn't have the most positive feeling about, you know, religious action in the first place, over this really nasty pall over everything they're doing. Anyway, I think it's a horrible made-for-TV movie. I thought it was insufferable. I did not find it entertaining like Patches did. I thought it was moving. But I don't think it's dangerous. I just think it's completely useless.
You shall not pass!
So the lightning crash you heard was the fist of God drawing a close to the end of our Soul Surfer conversation, because we have to move on to another release this week that stars Russell Brand and that I hear David Ehrlich didn't hate. Katie, why don't you tell us what Arthur's about?
Well, Arthur is a remake of another movie called Arthur, which I have not seen because it came out before I was born, but I think I will see it. Remake of a Dudley Moore movie. About
Katie only
a guy
sees films that
like,
come out.
Yeah, like they made movies before 1985.
That's
it's just
true. Anything that happened before Back to the Future doesn't exist. So it's about a rich guy, very rich guy, living in New York City. He does things. He's played by Russell Brand, who you may recognize from Forgetting Sarah Marshall. He does things like driving around New York in the Batmobile. He, you know, goes to the ATM and takes out 70 grand and gives it to whoever he is. He's a generally good-hearted guy, but very selfish and childish. And he's been cared for his whole life by Danny, played by Helen Mirren. And he's being forced into a marriage with Jennifer Garner, which he doesn't want, in order to save his family company. And he really loves Greta Gerwig, who is a poor girl who gives unlicensed tours of Grand Central, but has a good soul and
a heart of gold, you might say.
You might say she has a heart of gold. I think in the original, Liza Minnelli played a hooker in this part, but she's just a tour guide with a heart of gold because, I don't know, we don't do hookers anymore. So that's Arthur.
I don't know. I don't know if Liza Minnelli ever knew she was in the original Arthur. But
and it's quite
also,
cool
I can't find a fucking ATM in the city that will give me $100 without shorting out. I don't know what bodega he found that was $70,000 in it, but
you're super
that's
rich. These things materialize. I'm dying to hear David. I'm dying to hear you talk about what you liked in, because I did enjoy Arthur as well after a bumpy start. But our resident curmudgeon, what'd you like?
I'm not going to make my stupid Armin Verhoeven joke for the third time tonight because it was shameful the first time around. But
please do reference the joke we didn't hear. That's very helpful.
Oh, okay. I was talking about how I'm beginning to worry because I'd mentioned that I have only liked one. Jane Eyre was the only roughly studio film that I've seen this year that I thoroughly enjoyed, and Arthur was almost the second. And it made me feel a little bit like, you know, notorious curmudgeon Armin White, or Armin Very White, as I called myself, because if you know me, I'm very pale, and if you don't know me, you may have seen my biopic, Powder.
True.
I think that this is, you know, it's completely flaccid, unchallenging studio wankery, but at the same time, it's in all of its conventional wisdom, it is warm and witty. If you can't tolerate Russell Brand, this movie is going to make you want to drag out your large intestine and strangle yourself with it. But, you know, I think that if I knew him in real life, I would hate him. But I love and can quote from start to finish Forgetting Sarah Marshall. So watching him go about and say his things and have his chemistry with Helen Mirren. I mean, I thought the whole thing, I had a smile on my face the whole time. There are no real belly laughs, but it's very pleasant. It was weirdly refreshing in a way to see. I mean, they do present alcoholism, and Arthur is a unabashed alcoholic, but they presented it as something of an adventure, but it was at least nice to see it so unblinkingly portrayed, even if unrealistically so. But I thought it was just a really fun film that really was just – it was very pleasant. And after – on the heels of Your Highness, which was – a slog and a half of a quest. It was very refreshing. And the seats I sat on and the seats we sat on were made of very cushy leather. So that helped.
True. Patches, what'd you think? You sat next to me. You seemed to be enjoying it on the same level that I did.
Yeah, I liked it. It's all right.
Oh, no.
Well, we've already gotten to that point in the night, haven't we?
And suddenly we're into Oliver.
I enjoyed it. I don't know.
Please, sir, I want some more.
Oh, God.
The film is fine. It's so... I don't know if I've seen a movie this year that's so studio, so plain, so Hollywood, so boring in its execution, but in a comfortable way that's semi-enjoyable. It's like by the book in every possible way, which is kind of shocking with Russell Brand. You know, his previous movies, he's kind of out there doing crazy stuff. And here he's just doing his shtick and shooting it simply, and it's boring. And there are some funny one-liners. The man is an improv genius, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, there's some. I think some of the. I think even when the script kind of either gets really rote or like, you know, characters kind of transform for no reason. There's some. I think the line that we both laughed at was about him how he had a pet giraffe or something, and
yeah, and he ate its monocle.
Yeah, you were entertained by your pet giraffe. Yeah, until he ate his monocle.
Yay, we're going to ruin all the funny parts.
No, but I mean, I think that's the fun I had at that. Like, it's a movie that acknowledges the recession, but is unafraid to be a fantasy about, you know, it's not afraid or ashamed to repulse its viewers by having someone who's so disgustingly rich and has so little concern for his own wealth. It really sort of indulges in that. And, you know, as someone who has...
My actual favorite part was, free money, free money.
I have impressively little money, and I was, you know, for the 400 minutes that this movie eventually went on, I really sort of enjoyed partaking in his fun vicariously of being so fucking rich. And also Greta Gerwig, who has always been in movies that made me hate movies, is really adorable here. And all like the really cheesy bits had a nice like sweet sincerity to them. Like a Russell Branded spin on Love and Sex, starring
Russell
Jon Favreau.
Branded.
Yeah. No, I mean...
Dave, I'm curious about listening to this conversation, if you are surprised by us liking it or have any questions about us liking it.
All this means to me is that the multi-million dollar campaign to make American audiences love Russell Brand so they could deport him out of England and he could have a career here with Katy Perry seems to have worked on all three of you.
Yeah. It's true.
Although I don't think people are liking it very much from what
it has a 7% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, which is terrible.
Out of like how many reviews though? I mean,
no, like 12. I mean, I think it's going to go up, but it's been remarkable. I think a lot of people saw the original and are like, no, you can't.
Which is funny because I've seen the original. It's not very, I mean, it's fine. It's not a classic by any means. It's a decent film, but, This movie is just, it's not offensively bad. I would be hard pressed to, I would wonder why people are being so hard on it. I think it comes from either detesting Russell Brand or being able to stand him. There's no liking Russell Brand.
Well,
it's only
into it kind of. I mean, I saw Hop, which I really hated, and I
enjoyed Hop.
I know you did, but I went in kind of really like sour on Russell Brand. Like I was really ready not to like it. And in the first half hour or so, he really grated on me. He just kind of shrieked the whole time. But I think after a while, the movie grew on me and then he did too. And I don't know that I would like run out to see his next movie, but it did help me get over an automatic distaste for him, which, you know, wasn't easy to do.
You don't want to run out and see my new movie.
I'm Aldous Snow. Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit.
So
and
did
it's me impersonating Kristen Bell, impersonating Aldous Snow, who is a fictional character. I hope we're all on the same page.
We're all on the same page. And the question to both of you, given that we both like the movie and I think we're going to be in the minority, will you remember this movie in a year?
No.
Yeah. I don't think
no.
I will either.
I wouldn't
I'll never
remember
see
their
again,
names if they weren't up on my screen right now. So I don't really know. But, you know, after I was really ticked off and sort of rubbed the wrong way by the I felt like the celebration of mediocrity that we're seeing in with stuff like Source Code and Super and whatever else opens. I don't know. That's just using last week. I sat down and I was thoroughly entertained by this. I was not rubbed the wrong way.
Wait, David. Let me ask you a question. If you had to recommend Hannah or Arthur this weekend, what would you recommend to people?
That is. I mean.
Wait. Here comes the quote for someone's poster.
I mean, a more appropriate question might be to compare this to Your Highness.
Oh, no. I'm comparing it. I'm asking you Hannah or Arthur.
He's asking a tough question.
The film lover in me wants to appreciate the ambition and, you know, vision for what it is of Joe Wright with Hannah. But as far as the results are concerned, I mean, if you're talking purely about the effects of what they've done, I've got to go with Arthur. If I had to, you know... If sight
that's
unseen,
what you have to go on. That's what you have to. That's what
if
I'm
someone,
asking.
If sight unseen, someone was like, "Do you want to see the no Joe Wright movie, or do you want to see the no Jason Winder?" I want to say
he created Modern Family.
Did I get his name right? Okay.
Yeah.
Do I want to see? You want to see his? I mean, I pick Joe Wright, you know, every day. But Hannah, I found boring, and it was frustrating to me because I could appreciate what it was trying to do, and for me, failed to do on, you know, almost every conceivable level. And this was something that had a very modest ambition, and I thought exceeded its own lack of imagination. And I had a really good time watching it.
I will watch the fuck out of Arthur on a plane someday in the future. All right, fourth segment. Or third segment. I can't count.
Anymore. Feels like that.
It is the fourth segment. It's not the fourth segment.
We still haven't come up with a proper name for this. I think we all recognize that Go Fuck Yourself wasn't really working out the way we intended. I suggested Be in My Bonnet, in which you talk about the thing you can't stop thinking about. But
got
nobody.
My goat.
This, but then gets your goat, it suggests you don't like it. And this can be things you either do or don't like. Well, while we're thinking of a name for this, Dave, why don't you tell us the thing that you're thinking of right now?
Hey, so some of you might have noticed this week online, if you are an avid consumer of movie news, that Will Smith and his son Jaden Smith are going to be in the new M. Night Shyamalan sci-fi film, which is basically one of the worst news things ever that I've ever heard. And so I was trying to step back.
Makes the Hindenburg look like the Lusitania.
Yeah, I know. And like, oh. Who... I didn't know whether it was... Sorry. I didn't know whether it was M. Night or Jaden, and then I thought, maybe, you know what, maybe it's just Will Smith that I don't like about this. So I started going back and thinking about, like, what happened to Will Smith? Basically, what I could figure is that Obama got elected, and mainstream America was kind of only comfortable liking one, like, everyday black man, and we're like, you take the future of the nation, and then that all went to shit. And Will Smith decided to build his own little family dynasty, and now he's, like, kind of screwing Men in Black 3, and now this M. Night Shyamalan thing's coming along.
Can we argue that Men in Black 3 is screwing itself?
I don't know. I mean, I've been actively looking in.
Dave Gonzalez is the only living human who gives a shit about Men in Black 3.
I've been actively keeping track of his production.
I care about Men in Black 3.
The newest word on the street is, from Hollywood Reporter, that Will Smith's personal writer has been writing this film this whole time, and all the other writers, like, just figured out, like, a month ago.
My theory is that writer doesn't exist, and it's, in fact, Will Smith.
I mean, that would be perfectly believable to me. Here's my thesis. America could only really love one black man in the media focus at the time, and it's Obama's time to take into a second term, so it's okay to not like what Will Smith's doing, because you don't have to like him anymore, people. This isn't Independence Day Will Smith who's punching aliens and saving the world anymore. This is
but only half of America loves Obama. Like, the like Republicans need their own black guy, and I don't think Alan Keyes is cutting it.
Well, I mean,
Alan Keyes did very well in the South Carolina primaries.
Does Tyler Perry count for the Republican black man who everyone loves?
I think that's as close as you're going to get, because he certainly has some very... interesting ideas about
you want to
what
talk
the,
about Christian movies.
The
I mean.
African American community should do.
I don't.
Itself.
I don't want to talk about Christian movies.
Okay,
so that's my thing. I think it's okay for us to all not like Will Smith, because I think Will Smith should have to prove himself like anybody else who disappears and decides that he would rather spend his time making sure his children are also multimillionaires than entertaining the audience that made the Fresh Prince the king.
So that doesn't really have anything to do with Obama at all in the end.
Well, I mean, I think it's weird that the parallels have existed this way, but I think if we need to feel okay about, you know, liking a black man, which I think was a lot of the reason why Will Smith was kind of waved like a flag in front of all these summer tentpole movies, because it's like, we have a likable black man, oh my god. anything that he wants to say damn in, he can now. And we lived through like a decade of that.
What about like, I mean, first of all, neither Will Smith nor Barack Obama are really black. I mean, not as far as they've been.
Whoa.
As far as
whoa.
No, I mean, just as far
David.
As like middle. No, I don't mean that in any.
Listen,
Almond,
I think you might be stepping out of your depth.
No, I'm just saying, as far as America sees them, I mean, they're in their own sphere. I mean, it's Will Smith and Barack Obama. I think that, you know, certain more racially sensitive types might, you know, look in the White House and say, "Oh, we have a black man for president." But I think, you know, I think a lot of people look at these particular people and they see them as brands and they see them as historical figures, and the race doesn't really factor into it. At least
I don't think this is a conscious choice. I think America has decided that it's, you know, I think Will Smith was the pre, you know, racial awakening of middle America's, you know, touchstone that made it okay. And now that, you know, we have a black president, whether or not you think that matters, it's now in the zeitgeist as we don't need a African-American touchstone at the head of our tentpole movies. So I think we should find, you know, good actors and stuff. And this guy's obviously very interested in making a life for his kids. And I don't care how good Whip Your Hair is, it doesn't mean dynasties are okay.
But what you're really saying is we need to find our own black icon movie stars, and we're really just going to get Jaden Smith. You know,
I think what he's really saying is just that dynasties are not okay, and he's perturbed by the fact that Will Smith is stepping out of the spotlight himself in order to pave the way for Jaden and Willow.
I'm doing that, and I'm undercutting the guilt that you might feel for taking on Will Smith, because we've all been trained to love him. As you know,
him.
Yeah, as tentpole action star guy.
I loved him since I was 10. I didn't need any training.
But it's like, let's stop forgetting Pursuit of Happiness and 7 Pounds. And realize
I like Pursuit of Happiness.
And, yeah, but 7 Pounds was an abomination.
Anyway.
And realize that this guy is, you know, he's a Damon, you know, style actor that could... Wayans.
He's Damon Wayans.
I was going to say like Matt Damon and compare him to a white guy. I'm saying he's just a sphere of A-list actor that hasn't proven himself in a while.
But Matt Damon's awesome.
Yes, but he has proven himself recently.
I just reached for a white guy.
There's Denzel Washington in film. There's Kanye West in music. I mean, like, I don't necessarily think that we're at the point where we only have one slot for...
I think you only have one slot for everybody.
What I was saying earlier is that I think that, you know, I'm a Jew and I would love to see someone Jewish ascend to any sort of, you know, political level. But I see Joe Lieberman. I don't see him as a Jew. I see him as an asshole. I mean, I don't think that like I need that one guy. I think that, you know, I think that there's been, I don't think Will Smith precludes having other black movie stars. I think that he's paving the way for his own dynasty, which bothers you, and The Karate Kid was fine, so it doesn't bother me, and his kids, whatever. They're not competing with me for jobs and attention. But, you know, I think that there's plenty of evidence out there that he's not usurping the spotlight as far as black actors are concerned.
No, but I think what Dave's argument is that people don't want, like, the studios don't want to have black stars because they are terrified they won't sell overseas, so that they could say, oh, wait, but we have Will Smith, so we're diverse. But he is not allowing us to use that excuse anymore.
Oh, I didn't hear that argument from Dave, but that makes sense.
I'm just saying, America, when Will Smith comes back, his projects look like they're not going to be very good. We don't have to like him just because we liked him in the 90s.
But people will vote with their dollars. I mean, like, nobody...
No, people
nobody
very frequently are just like, hey, no. I mean, if the Beaver does well, everyone's going to forget.
Am I misremembering 7 Pounds is a $300 million blockbuster?
It made a lot of money overseas, believe it or not.
Yeah, overseas, which is what, you know, your concern is. But, I mean, as far as we're concerned, it's not as if everyone is so blithely accepting of what he does that they're going to rush out and support it. I mean... 7 Pounds was, in Katie Rich's words, an abomination. I think that, you know, being kind. I don't know.
What are we talking about?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. Is it dynasties? Is it black?
Oh, hell no.
This is the bee that's been in my bonnet all week, and now it's your guys' bee. Let's move on.
David, what are you thinking about?
Now I'm thinking about black actors.
Well, then let's talk about Anthony Mackie, shall we?
Speaking of black actors, Attack the Block, which stars a emaciated time traveling 50 Cent as Moses, and For those of you who have seen the film, which I mean Matt Patches, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Anyway, Attack the Block was the toast of South by Southwest, which is deeply unfortunate considering that the festival hosted Kill List and a bunch of other really good movies. But Attack the Block is a fun, rousing piece of entertainment, and people in the nerd core have been clamoring about it.
Hey, what's it about?
It's about it's like Fish Tank meets Critters, or what did I say? Fish Tank. It's about a bunch of kids in a block or a housing complex, like an inner city housing complex in England, it's like a little gang of kids, and an alien invasion happens very locally and only locally, and they have to fend it off.
And what made it so great? Or what made everyone else like it?
It's a really rousing, intelligently put together action film that is, despite the fact that it's made by a first-time filmmaker, Joe Cornish, is confident from front to back.
Everyone saw it, they were drunk.
We all were. I was my first time at the Alamo Drafthouse. I was very drunk, both on the drunken alcohol that I was drinking and the atmosphere. And it was the perfect audience to see it. And it's played, it's gone over crazily in L.A. It's a really solid piece of entertainment. But I guess if we're talking about like whatever is in my bonnet, it's just that, I'm just seeing this. Maybe it's just my own alienation or
dissatisfaction. Alienation.
But, I'm seeing a lot of celebration of films that I believe to be deeply mediocre because there's a void to fill. There, people who love movies feel as if they need to actively love movies. And as I was saying earlier, like I've seen one studio film this year that I've responded to in any way. Attack the Block is a really fun movie. It wasn't one of my five favorite films I saw at South By. It's not one of my top 10 films of the year already. And we're only in the beginning of April. But other people obviously responded to it very strongly. And I just think
are you glad that it's getting distributed?
I'm very glad that it's getting distributed. Okay. I think it absolutely deserves to be seen. But I think that it's
the people who brought us Resident Evil.
I think my problem is just to distill it. It's just that the excitement over it is troubling to me. I don't know. It's just these are the only films that seem to be getting championed because they appeal to a certain element. And I would love to have seen the support behind something a little bit, or any measure of the support behind something a little bit smaller, a little bit, more unconventional, and that appealed to a different element. But it's all reserved. All the enthusiasm is reserved for this movie, which so brazenly appeals to this audience. And it's a really good movie. I can't wait for everyone to see it. But I just the enthusiasm around it is complete. It's like snow when it's like having a rock concert in a field of snow. It's like the sound just gets sucked up by the ground, and you don't hear anything else, which deserves to be.
I kind of want to watch Scott Pilgrim vs. the World now.
It's also the film is not. I don't think it stacks up to Edgar Wright's worst day, and he's an executive producer, so it's a pertinent analogy. But I think people are so desperate to champion something. I feel like Attack the Block is getting a lot of benefit from that. It will probably be considered a classic already because of his reputation. Good movie. I don't know. I'm just,
All right. I'm hitting the David Ehrlich buzzer.
Yeah. I mean,
you guys didn't help me refine my contempt.
I haven't seen it.
Steer me in another direction.
I have nothing.
It's complaining about a movie that I really enjoyed.
All right. I'm going to talk about the thing that I'm thinking about, which is very short and vague. I'm thinking about mustaches on men because I saw...
Hey, I'm also thinking about that.
Hey, maybe you'll have something to add. I saw A Fish Called Wanda for the first time last night, as I've written about on the blog and tweeted about. And I adored it because I grew up loving Kevin Kline, and weirdly it took me forever to see it. And he has an awesome mustache in this movie, and he kind of always rocked the mustache back in the days. And then I saw this picture on Vulture of Clive Owen on a red carpet with a mustache, and then Darren Aronofsky apparently shaved his mustache, and I just wanted to speak out in support of the mustache. My dad has one. He's had one for like my entire life. It can look good if you make it work, and I support the hipster return of it, and I think more movie stars should wear them. When was the last time there was a movie with an actor with a mustache? Like
John
on the
Hodgman
screen?
In Arthur.
All right. Boom. John Hodgman.
Where were all of you on my Facebook poll yesterday that caused me to shave my mustache? I saw you, Katie.
Katie, are you going to make your boyfriend grow a mustache now?
Yeah, he has the whole stubble thing going on. I don't know. Maybe I'll get him a mustache. But he's not a movie star. He's not like, I don't know. He's not going to make the trend work.
Wow. I'm sorry that your boyfriend's not a trendsetter.
I know.
Hey,
well,
Katie,
maybe, I didn't know if a mustache did anything for you.
I support it. Honestly, I think just not being like, I'm talking about like the Tom Selleck mustache, you know, like even Darren Aronofsky didn't quite have that going on. But that's what Kevin Kline has in A Fish Called Wanda, and I like it.
Sorry, you mentioned Tom Selleck's mustache. I immediately go to Mr. Baseball when he's telling Hiroko in the audience. He says, she's like, in America, they give mustache rides at baseball games. It's the best, most offensive mustache moment in movie history, in case anyone was wondering what that might be.
I might debate that, but that would require more research.
Hey, all Katie, right. Do you know if Kevin Kline can speak French fluently or if he
yes,
is
he
just
can.
Making it?
He can.
In this movie, Queen to Play.
He's in this French movie called Queen to Play, which I saw at Tribeca like 2 years ago, and he speaks French throughout the entire movie.
That's why
he,
I'm
he
asking.
He can speak fluent French.
Yeah. Kevin Kline needs to be in more lead roles in comedies, aside from The Extra Man, which was terrible.
He should be in more movies called Dave.
Yeah. Maybe more movies called Dave or called In-N-Out.
Oh, In-N-Out's so good.
All right, we got one more to go, and then we're done with this extra rambly podcast.
So we're supposedly done. I'm sorry. Yeah. Katie, could you do that intro again? I talked over it.
Oh, we got one more of us to go before we're done with this super rambly podcast. Patches, what do you got on your mind?
Yeah, I'll bring up something that we kind of been talking about this whole last week, which was Source Code. It premiered last weekend and did well at the box office, I think, if I recall. And it did quite well critically as well. And I think all of us would agree that that is confusing because Source Code is not a good movie. I mean, I thought it was a very boring film and a stray away from director Duncan Jones's first film, Moon, which I thought was stylistic. Not the greatest film the way it's heralded by some, but, quite entertaining and
Wait,
stylish.
Director Duncan Jones or genius Duncan Jones?
My point, if you'd let me get there, is that we're kind of on Duncan Jones's dick a little bit. And we're on people's dick a lot, especially the creators who talk to us, who are very vocal on in the Twitter world and who've kind of mastered social media in a way that I think is taking away from our critical look at their work. And in that way, I don't feel like Duncan Jones is going to grow positively from the Source Code experience. I think he's going to end up leaving thinking that it was a success in a way that it shouldn't be because of all this positive energy we're giving him. And kind of it feels like we're giving him a pass a little bit on Source Code. So I don't know if we're retreading into territory, Katie, or not. But
I will say that I've thought about the semantics of this a lot, and I actually think that we're up Duncan Jones's butt.
Wait, so we're not on his dick.
We're up
with our dicks, or with our lady dicks, because I think that I don't know. I guess because
the next
we're
thing,
giving him the pleasure.
Is it
know.
Because the next thing he shits out, we're all going to be there?
Yes, it's going to over us.
Either way, we would because I would give the. I think the man is quite intelligent. I think he's a good filmmaker. That's evidenced by both films. But I'm just thinking. Well, obviously, we're going to be there for whatever he does next because he's intriguing. But I think we're not helping filmmakers, especially the ones who interact with us the most. We're not helping them advance themselves. And I think
that's
about Kevin Smith,
movies.
Too.
It's bad
it is,
for
it
movies.
It is bad for movies in a way. I like having that relationship, and I like that they're open, and I like that they're vocal, and I like that they talk about and interact with people. But we aren't doing them a service by being easy on the film or not talking about it critically, not talking about it as pundits of the film world as opposed to just buddies and fans of this guy.
I think just to kind of pull back to something that Katie and I talked about when you guys were at South by Southwest, I'm really happy to see Source Code getting this well-reviewed because it's an original property by a director that, you know, went and made his first tiny, visually stunning movie, and then, you know, they gave him a little bit more money, and he did something, and it did fine. That's great. I want to see Duncan Jones move on. Limitless is still doing well, even though I didn't really think that Limitless is going to be, like, a movie we all remember. I'm happy that it's still doing well, because these, like, tiny spring original concept movies that have, like, one star and a reasonable budget and, like, take a chance on X and Y director. I think that is what the future of like these this studio system.
But if they're not that good, then should we still be championing them the way that we are?
Well, I mean, I think that as long as it's a step forward, it doesn't. It's like for Duncan Jones, he now has a well-reviewed movie that is going to be profitable that had Jake Gyllenhaal on it. He's going to have another chance to make a visually interesting movie.
But is he going to challenge himself? Because
that's what Patch is
saying. Starting
he's
to give us a pass.
By this experience,
I think it's fine. I think it's fine if Rotten Tomatoes is giving it these awesome scores, and the layperson that might be trying to pick a movie chooses something interesting based on that. I'm fine with that. The one thing that's nice about Duncan Jones being so into the community is after we let Source Code have a little room to breathe, he better hear out what we have to say and take it to heart, because he's part of the community. It's not like Duncan Jones goes away when his press cycle goes away.
No,
like it is for everybody else.
He's definitely on our dicks. I'm sorry, Patches. You were right.
Yes, that's what I thought. I was thinking for one second that we were up his butt. No, but he's on
our
dick.
This like 69 image. He's definitely on our dicks.
Okay. Duncan Jones, we're on to you. We're going to keep an eye on you. And
we're either on or in your something.
It's not Duncan Jones's fault. It's this pressure that you're going to so and so follows you on Twitter, and your opinion is obviously going to be modified. I mean, you're not going to tweet when it's an aggressive bit of social networking where he's actively waiting for your thought to tumble down there, and you're going to say Source Code was a giant piece of shit. It's just not. And the silence is also deafening. So people say things. I'm not going to cast aspersions on individuals because some people genuinely like the movie and they're entitled to, and they happen to be friendly with Duncan Jones. But it's that movie's a piece of shit.
Yeah, it's not a piece of shit.
I actually think I saw it and I was like, that was mediocre. And as it's been marinating for the past few weeks, I think it's a terrible, terrible movie.
I'm gonna try and wrap up this podcast since I feel like we've been talking forever.
If I don't end every segment by saying "and also," and then you just step in, and
we'll make it work that way.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me tonight, guys, and for this has been a good conversation. If a long one, I'll take a long and good over short and mediocre any day.
That's what Duncan Jones said.
Patches, having started all these dick references, why don't you close us out and tell us who you are?
Matt Patches. You can follow me and find all my work at mattpatches.com and on Twitter at Mr. Patches.
David, who are you?
Yeah, I'm David Ehrlich. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and Criterion Corner. You can also find me at Mr. Besubaru, which is a Twitter account I set up 2 years ago to tweet every time Mr. Baseball was on TV. For curious minds that wanted to know. I think I tweeted twice, which is more followers than I had. But it's important that Cinemax starts playing it again, that could pick up a lot of heat.
All right. And Dave, as the hero who edits this podcast, in addition to being on it, and will have a lot to work with tonight, who are you? How do we find you?
My name's Dave. You spell that D-A-7-E, which is my Twitter handle, which is where I will let you know where everything that's happening that involves shit that I do, because I do a lot more than write at Latino Review Weekly. As you will hopefully know before next week's podcast, David Ehrlich and I might have something to let you know about.
Oh, that's a very sly bit of peer pressure you got there.
did it work?
No, because...
okay, don't plug it then. That's it. I'm Dave, D-A-7-E. You can find me on Twitter.
No, it works. Yeah, it'll be fine.
All right. All right. I'm Katie. I'm here at Cinema Blend in Kino, Katie, and I'm very excited to have Operation Kino up and running, and we'll talk to you guys next week about...
We got a name this week, so don't complain about it being too long or anything, or me eating or shit when I'm talking. We got a name. Next week, we'll be concise. All right.
Just turn your fan back on and eat some spaghetti.
Or just swallow before you yell at us.
No.
That's what Duncan Jones said.
Oh!
What?
That's what we're going out on right there.
I was so glad I could participate in that. All right, that's it. Bye, guys.
Everything that keeps us together is falling apart. I got this thing that I consider my only art of fucking people over.
heart.